Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's just about 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, December the 19th. We will be talking with a guest this hour who says there are two food systems in America, the one for the poor and the local, organic, and highly nutritious food available to everyone else. He calls this the food gap, and he'll offer some solutions to this growing problem. And we will welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Mark Winnie was the executive director of the Hartford Food System, a private nonprofit agency that works on food and hunger issues in the Hartford, Connecticut area. He was an organizer and chairman of the Working Lands Alliance, a statewide coalition working to preserve Connecticut's farmland, and is the founder of the Connecticut Farmland Trust. He currently writes, speaks, and consults on community food system topics, including hunger and food insecurity, local and regional agriculture, and food policy. He is the author of the book Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thanks a lot for being with us. You know, I was thinking about this today because later today I have been invited to a holiday get-together with work colleagues with the University of Wisconsin Extension. It's the annual holiday party, and the price of admission is donating food for the underprivileged. Bring some non-perishable items that can go to the local food pantry. This is something that a lot of us do around this time of year, isn't it?
Oh yes, mm-hmm. Very popular to become more generous than we normally are during the holidays.
Yeah, but that's not the answer, you say.
No, I don't think it is. My concern is that we've been doing that now for a long time. The kind of organizations that are recipients of that kind of donation, the food pantries, soup kitchens, food banks, continue to grow. People seem to forget that we didn't really have that many of those kinds of sites in the early 1980s. It was during that time when the federal government began to shrink from its responsibility to ensure the social welfare of Americans that there was a sudden explosion in the number of food banks. And since that time, when there were probably less than 1,000 such sites in the entire country, today there's over 50,000. That's one aspect of what I consider two food systems, one for the poor and one for everybody else.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that that's evidence in my mind of a food gap that too many people are. In fact, it's something like 10% of all Americans will use a food bank at least once a year. So is that the place where we want a large segment of our population to be getting their food? Or should we be thinking about how we can normalize our food system so that everybody has equal opportunity to the same nutritious, healthy, and affordable food?
Yeah. You say that this became more of a problem, post Reagan years?
That's right.
Yeah. But hasn't, poverty, low income, struggling to put food on the table been a problem that's been with us for a much longer time than that?
It's been with us for a long time. A little history going back to the 1960s, we began to, quote, rediscover, unquote, poverty in the United States. It had certainly been there, but it hadn't been in the limelight. Through a number of actions by politicians and the federal government, it suddenly became known that, there were Americans who were poor and there were Americans that were hungry. In fact, their health was seriously impaired by hunger and malnutrition. And as a result, we got moving on that issue. The food stamp program, as we more or less know it today, began during the Kennedy administration. A number of other food assistance or federal food programs began during the 60s and then into the 70s. And we actually started to make progress in reducing hunger during that period. You know, it's popular these days, I think, to kind of disparage government and often to disparage particularly the Great Society programs and the war on poverty that began in the 60s. But, in fact, they made an enormous dent on these problems. We started to backslide in the early 80s when the government again began to come shrink back. And, in fact, what happened was the responsibility for trying to solve the problems and mitigate the conditions of poverty and hunger fell increasingly to the private sector. And that's when we began to see this explosion in the number of emergency food programs.
Yeah. So what's wrong with expecting or letting this fall to the private sector rather than the government somehow putting the food on the table?
Well, I think there's a number of things wrong with it. First of all, I guess the one thing that I always think about is, you know, I'm lucky in the sense that I have sufficient income. I can go to a food store on a regular basis. The only thing that I ever have to worry about is whether to use a MasterCard or a Visa when I check out my groceries at the checkout counter. That, for us, or for most of us, is the normal food system. Mm-hmm. Why should a whole another segment of our population be lined up to get free bags of groceries or the food that is essentially salvaged or, in some cases, wasted or surplused? You know, the extra food that society casts off is kind of what we look to as the way of feeding an increasingly large segment of the population. Keep in mind that if I receive food stamps or some other voucher or form of assistance, I can at least go to the supermarket like a normal person and or go to the farmer's market in many cases and buy food along with everybody else. That's really the kind of, you know, equality that I think we, in fairness, that I think we come to expect in the United States.
Yeah. So what sorts of government policies do you think are needed to be formed or reestablished that would help bridge this food gap?
Well, you know, here's one statistic that I sometimes forget about, and maybe I do it because I'm a little embarrassed by it, but the fact that the United States spends less as a percentage of its gross domestic product, that's the GDP, or our national wealth, in effect. We spend less on social welfare and anti-poverty programs than just about any industrialized nation in the country. The only two nations who are behind us are Mexico and Russia. That's not a good reflection on a country that's as wealthy as we are. So I think the underlying solution to this is to begin to get back into the work of ending poverty. We forgot about that. Somewhere along the line, in our frenzy to feed the hungry, and as we saw their numbers exploding, and acting compassionately in a way that we are programmed to do, frankly, that we forgot about the underlying causes. And therefore, I think the way to begin to readdress and reassess this problem is look at what are some of the ways that we can effectively reduce the poverty in this country, which in effect will increase the ability of people to buy food from normal locations like supermarkets and elsewhere.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is that, you know, I find that when I talk to people about their local communities, it's interesting to ask someone, all right, where do you think most of the free food comes from? What's the percentage? And in other words, how much money is going for food from places like, say, the food stamp program? And how much is coming from, private sources like food banks? Most people guess that it's about 80% private or food banks and about 20% federal government. In fact, the numbers are almost is well reversed. It's almost over 90% of the food that will come into any community or any state that's available to lower-income people is coming from the federal government, and the rest is coming from private sources. So people are thinking that the solution is more canned food, when in fact I think the solution is to look at those federal food programs as at least a short-term solution to mitigate hunger and food, what we call food insecurity in this country.
Yeah.
And we have evolved over 15 separate federal food programs, which has no other parallel in the industrialized democratic world. You go to France or England or Japan or just about anywhere else, you won't find such a huge commitment in terms of food. What you'll find is a welfare system that is designed to meet all your needs. And in fact, what we have done is create this sort of division where we regard our problems as something, our social problems, as something that can be resolved for the most part by food programs. It creates a very complicated system. So I think the other thing we need to do is to consider how we can increase the funding for food programs so that we're going to eliminate hunger and at the same time consolidate these programs so we don't have such a mishmash of approaches to addressing nutritional needs. And at the same time, we need to become more aggressive and more effective in our anti-poverty efforts.
We're talking with Mark Winney. He is author of the book Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. He says there are two food systems in America, the one for the poor and the one for everyone else. And it's time to bridge that gap by ending poverty. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or talk at WPR.org. We welcome your thoughts and questions for him. Do you agree with what he's saying, or do you challenge it? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later today, it's John Munson in for Ben Marins for At Issue between 4 and 6. What were the most significant medical advancements in 2007? John and his guest will discuss 2007 and the year in medicine, coming up after 5 this afternoon. We are talking about closing the food gap with Mark Winney, who is the author of this book and has been working on food insecurity issues pretty much all of his life. Mark Winney, did you leave the food bank that you co-founded because of, I don't know, the realization that that maybe wasn't the answer to this problem?
Well, in the short version of my history is that I began in Hartford, Connecticut, running an organization called the Hartford Food System, which mm-hmm. was really designed to develop the self-reliance of individuals living in very low-income urban communities. By growing their own food, by developing farmers markets, by actually running food co-ops, we were not in the business of starting a food bank. That was forced on us in the early 1980s when we had no more than 4 or 5 places in the entire area where people could get free food from food pantries or soup kitchens. Today, there's over 375 such sites, and you'll find that kind of explosion mirrored in community after community around the country. So we were not determined to get into the food banking business at all, and were forced to, and I found myself involved in co-founding a food bank that's now called FoodShare, that's the sort of main food bank for the Hartford, Connecticut area. To answer your question, that whole process I began to find very discouraging. I said, I found myself on occasion, shoveling rotten potatoes out of the food bank warehouse. They'd been donated to us by some, good soul who thought that they had, enough enough nutritional value to feed some people. But you know, when they were received by us, they were mm-hmm. nearly rotten, and they were really ready for the compost pile. I found myself receiving donated moose parts that had been from a moose that the Fish and Game Division in the state had put down because it had been wandering through too many suburban backyards. I said, this is not the way that a country should be feeding its people. And I began to pull back from that enterprise, though I continued to work with the food bank because I saw it filling an important need that wasn't being filled by anybody else. But I think what we wanted to do was begin to return and to the idea of economic self-reliance. We began to develop new supermarkets in the city, which is another aspect of the food gap. I think if you drive through just about any urban community, particularly one where there's larger, lower-income areas, and even if you drive through many rural parts of our country, you'll find increasingly a lack of good, affordable food retail stores.
Right, and it's more expensive. It's that doesn't have a lot of great produce. That sort
of
thing.
And this, we're calling these areas. Perhaps that's a kind of a derogatory term, but these are food deserts. They're places where it's difficult to find healthy, affordable food. And so we began to return to that mission of trying to develop local self-reliance. By developing supermarkets, by bringing in more farmers markets, by looking at the way that we could help farmers in the 1980s who were just not having good luck finding markets for their product. You got to remember that the whole local food craze and the organic food craze was not yet a craze.
Yeah.
And that people were just beginning to rediscover their local farmers and their local food. So we saw that as a way to help bridge the food gap, that we could develop farmers markets in low-income communities and give them a good source of fresh, affordable food. At the same time, we could provide new markets for farmers. So that was the direction that we began to head, and that and realizing that food banking was not the answer in the long term. Perhaps it was a short-term way that we had to go, but we had to look at other ways to really help people help themselves.
Yeah. We have a number of callers, but do you still think the establishment of supermarkets in inner cities or these food deserts the establishments of community gardens and farmers markets in urban areas, those are still viable, good solutions to bridging the food gap?
Absolutely. I think we need to take communities where, look, just compare a low-income community to a vibrant urban or suburban community, where you find more and more choice than you've ever found before in terms of food. Pretty soon there's going to be a Whole Foods store on every corner, at least in affluent communities in America. We need to begin to restore some normalcy to communities that are woefully underserved by our food retail system.
Yeah. And what about those of us who are asked to donate to the food bank? Should we still do that?
That's a choice you need to make, but I think the way you make that decision is to get more information about the issues that we're talking about. I know that there are programs out there that are helping people connect lower-income families to farms to get fresh produce from those farms. They're called community-supported agriculture, or CSA. That might be an alternative. Make a donation that will help that family take advantage of fresh local produce.
Nina in Oconomowoc. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I find this very interesting, this hour. Last year, I was pregnant and went from, I had some problems with my pregnancy, and I ended up losing my job, and I went from earning, quite a bit of money to bringing in no income, and my situation went from, being able to go to basically whatever grocery store I wanted to buy whatever food I wanted to relying on a food bank. And it was such a shock to me when I went and I got the food from the food bank, and, you know, half of the food had expired already, and half of the food, you know, the other half that was left, it was so much processed food that I wasn't used to eating, you know, so everything was canned food, you know, not a lot of fresh food. And so it was just such an eye-opening experience to me personally, seeing, you know, this is the food that I was used to eating, and then completely changing, you know, my food intake. And the one thing that I can say really helped, that I think is a wonderful program, is the WIC program, which, you know, provides mothers and young children with fresh fruit juice and milk and for, you know, some children formula. So that, I think, is a wonderful program that really also helped me. But it was just very interesting to see, you know, the kinds of food that we got from the food bank.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Nina, for sharing your experience, and that's an experience you're familiar with, Mark Winnie.
Yes, it's a very important story, and it's one that needs to be told often, that people who, you know, may suffer some setbacks in their lives, you know, are suddenly have their choices restricted. And I know food banks are doing the best they can. I mean, if they could get really good food all the time and be able to meet the demand all the time, they certainly would. But they're operating in a you know, the sort of the cast-off market, the seconds market, you might say, in our food system. And that's the food they have available most of the time. And unfortunately, those people, like Nina, who are in the situation where they need to go to a food bank, that's the food that's going to be available to them. Again, these are the two food systems, the one for the poor or those who are not well off at a particular point in time, and the one for everyone else. And I think I agree with the WIC program as well. It's a wonderful program that provides really nutritious food to people, particularly young children who are developing their eating habits early on in life. We want them to develop healthy eating habits, but we also want them to have healthy food so that they're going to grow well in their early years, when it's so important. And you know, that's the kind of program that we want to see more support for.
Yeah, and we want our kids to have good, healthy food too, so they're not, I don't know, just eating a bunch of empty calories and starchy foods. And look at all the kids with the obesity right now.
That's right, and mm-hmm. I've always been impressed that the WIC program has also participates in providing vouchers to their participants, so that they can shop at farmers markets and buy fresh produce at farmers markets as well. And there's actually been a recent change in that program that's going to allow WIC participants to be able to purchase even more fresh produce. It's going to take a year or more to put this into place, but that's going to be another very, you know, progressive change that's going to allow people to just eat better.
Yeah, in fact, we had an email from Stacy in Milwaukee, and I think you just addressed this, talking about there used to be a program in New York that allowed food stamp users to spend their food stamps at local farmers markets, and she wonders if you know much about this, or whether this is a common practice. Now, that's food stamps as opposed to the WIC program.
Well, I think what she's talking about is that the food stamp program, since it switched from paper coupons to you know, smart cards or, you know, plastic cards, debit cards, and they use what's called the electronic benefit transfer system, which is basically just a swipe card at a grocery store. That technology has been difficult to use at farmers markets because they're outdoors, they're temporary, and so forth. Increasingly, we're finding that, you know, there's money available to bring that technology into farmers markets so that they can use their food stamp benefits that are encoded on that swipe card at a farmers market. So we're seeing that kind of program is growing. That may be what she's describing.
Yeah. Next, we go to George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Yeah, hi. Last week, I read an article in The Economist that predicted that food prices are likely to go rather sharply higher overall, a lot of it due to the increase in oil prices and the using up of a lot of the corn stock and making a lot more ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if your guest could comment.
Yes, I just read the same article, and it was a little scary. I think I'm particularly concerned about the impact of food price increases on low-income people. They don't have any flexibility. And, oftentimes a low-income family is spending about 20% or more of its annual income on food compared to about 10% for the rest of us. So if we see a 5% increase or inflationary increase in the price of food in any given year, that's going to mean additional burdens and a more significant impact on low-income families than we have on everybody else. But either way, it's a concern that our food system is now being required to produce fuel as much as it is to produce food. And is this the best direction for us? I think the number that's quoted in that article is that the filling an SUV with ethanol, one fill up, is basically the equal in terms of calories to feed one person for a year. So I think maybe we ought to be looking at energy conservation and other strategies at the same time that we're looking at other using our agricultural lands to also produce energy.
Thank you, George. Katie in Mequon. Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. The question was brought up is it is important to donate food or what else to do. And I think it is important to donate food. Just be aware of what you're donating. And going back to Dina, in Oconomowoc, what she got from WIC is very healthy and very well-thought-out program. And some of these, when people donate food, they donate things with highly processed and things like that. So when you donate, just be aware of what you're donating. And then if you don't want to donate, you want to be more proactive, then you need to, get into the government side of things and being, talking to your senator and changing the budget, because every year the food share program or food stamp program or WIC might get cut with budget cuts and things like that. The other thing that I see on a daily basis is that these people come in and they want to apply for food stamps, but they're like 5% over income. So sometimes the flexibility and income levels can go up and down, which is sad to see when you know that they're starving, but they can't get it because of their 5% over the income limit.
Katie, thank you very much. And she brings up an interesting point that you bring up as well, Mark Winnie, that that working on the political side of this and lobbying our lawmakers and our policymakers would probably be more effective in closing the food gap than donating that can of beans to the food pantry.
Well, that's right. The caller makes a very good point that if we see currently about 60% of the people that are we consider eligible for the food stamp program, or 60% of the people who are eligible for the food stamp program, if we could increase that to only 65%, or if we could increase their benefits by about 10%, which would have a substantial impact on food insecurity, that increase alone more than exceeds the amount of food that's distributed by all of the food banks in the country every year. So in other words, we're only making a very small impact by increasing our food donations from food banks. But if we got more political about it, as the caller suggests, if we talked to our members of Congress and said, let's stop this system where by people are hungry in this country, and let's provide ample benefits so that no child goes to bed hungry at night, that nobody has to skip a meal in order to let their children eat. If we did begin to engage our policymakers in this whole process, it would probably be time better spent than continuing to, you know, think about how much food we can donate to a food bank. I don't discourage people from doing that because it's still a necessary Band-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a Band-Aid, and we have to look at the long-term solutions. And I think working with our members of Congress to solve this is critical. And there's one other thing. Don't just think that the solutions lie in Washington. They also lie in your state capitol and at City Hall. You have a great little new effort in Dane County and in Madison called the Dane County Food Policy Council. I know some of the people with that mm-hmm. program, and they're starting to look at how both state and local government and county government can become more engaged in addressing food problems throughout Wisconsin.
Now we go to Mary in Janesville. Hi, Mary.
Good morning, Joy, and thank you very much for this show. I think this is a very important topic. I wanted to bring two things up that I have helped me, and I'm not poor, but I could see how it would make a big difference and a big impact on someone who was having problems. One of the things that we have become accustomed to in our culture is the you can get everything here grocery store. And if it doesn't have a bakery, and it doesn't have a gift shop, and it doesn't have a pharmacy, and it doesn't have a deli, and it doesn't have a select food section, well, it's just not good enough. We're not going there. And then there's Aldi's. Aldi's is a grocery store chain that has adopted a whole different philosophy. They have high-quality stuff at low prices because they don't go for all the glitz and all the glamour. It's a whole different marketing scheme, and it's a whole different product line, and the stuff is good quality, and it's just a lot cheaper. It's educating people on where to shop, I think, is just as important as educating people on what programs to get involved in. There's another program for people who volunteer. It's called Share. If you volunteer so many hours a month, you can get really good food prices. Once a month, you get a Share food package. I think it's like around $17 or something like that, which provides fresh fruits and vegetables in season. They work with local farmers. It provides meats, canned goods.
Right, that's like the community supported agriculture program, right?
Wonderful program, and anyone can get involved in that program, regardless of income level. All you have to do is volunteer a couple of hours a month, wherever, at your church, at your school, at your whatever. At any rate, the point is there has to be something. People have to take, if it's not coming to them, they have to go to it, I guess is the point.
I'm sorry, Mary, we got both of your points, and I will get Mark Winnie to respond to both of those after we take this scheduled break. Talking with Mark Winnie, he is author of the book Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. If you would like to talk with him about this growing problem that he addresses in the book, that being that we have two food systems in America, one for the poor and one for everyone else, and he says the poor too often are left to, the scraps of our food system, whereas the rest of us can get nutritious, local, organic foods. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn and her guest will examine the surge in Iraq and the status of foreign troops stationed there. That's coming up after 9. And then after 10, can people be born to be bad or genetically predisposed? Talking about the scientific and personal roots of evil coming up after 10. We're talking about how to bridge the food gap or close the food gap between the haves and the have-nots with our guest, Mark Winnie, who was the executive director of the Hartford Food System, a private nonprofit agency that works on food and hunger issues in the Hartford, Connecticut area. He currently writes, speaks, and consults on Community food system topics, including hunger and food insecurity, local and regional agriculture, and food policy. He is the author of the new book, Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. We just heard from Mary in Janesville, Mark, who says that a supermarket like Aldi's would be a good choice for everyone, but especially those who are watching their food dollars. What do you say to that?
I think it's a great idea. I mean, if you have a model of a store that is, you know, concentrating on healthy and affordable food, I say go there, support it. I think that our marketing system has for food has become a bit confusing, to say the least, over the last 5 or 10 years. And in the rush to meet all kinds of demands, we've created these emporiums, which frankly are selling a lot of processed food, a lot of junk food, a lot of overpriced, high-calorie food. And, there are good alternatives out there, as she says. I'm not familiar with that particular chain, but I do know that, we have choices. And I think that what we need to do is make sure that everybody, regardless of where they live or what their income is, has that choice. Mm-hmm. And, that's the point I want to make, that, that choice means that you're going to have sufficient income, you're going to be able to have access or be able to, get to that food, whether it's a farmer's market or some other, or a high quality discount kind of limited selection store. So that's the direction I think we want to be heading in this country.
Yeah. She also wanted to point out that a program in her area called Share, I think this is a community-supported agriculture program, will give people food if they volunteer to help pick it.
Right. I mean, that's a program that it's popular in some parts of the country. I don't believe it's just about farms. That's a little bit different. This is food that's available from other sources as well. But it meets a part of the need, and it's another good innovation that can help people on limited food budgets.
Diane in Madison is with us now. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I'd just like to say that I'm a poor person, and I have been using the Share program, and you can go and pick out the foods you'd like for the month, and you order them the beginning of the month and pick them up on the third Friday of the month close by to where I live. I also get vouchers for the farmer's market for the fresh produce, and it seems to me that the only people who really use the vouchers and take them are the Laotian people. You cannot go and get meat. You can't get any of the other fancy schmancy foods, but you can get produce and raspberries when they're in season there. So I take advantage of that. And when I cook, I make a bean soup or something, and I put it in the freezer. So I have food practically all year round. You have to, know how to do that kind of thing if you are a poor person. And I learned that from my grandmother and my mother, because we were poor when we grew up, and that's the only way to do it. And there's a lot of programs you can take advantage of.
Yeah, we just got another email, Bobby in Wisconsin Rapids, wanting to clarify if there is a difference between the Community Share program and community-supported agriculture. Diane, are you still there? No, she hung up. You know that these are different, right, Mark? When you say that there's other foods involved with the Share program,
right? Community supported agriculture is a way that farmers connect with the community to market their produce directly, and an individual or family buys a share in that farm every year, kind of like almost like a magazine subscription, and once a week or at some periodic basis, they will pick up their share of the harvest at the farm, or maybe the food is brought to a central location for redistribution. The other share program has been established for a long time and relies on individuals in the community to volunteer in different ways. Food is available from the food that is gathered and people take advantage of. Some of it may come from farms, but most of it, I believe, comes from more conventional sources.
So most of this food in the SHARE program would be the canned, non-perishable
things? Well, you'd find meat, find produce, you'll find, I believe you'd find cereals and canned food and beans and, just about, it varies a lot. The selection is very limited, and there's a small fee that you have to pay also on a monthly basis.
Yeah. I guess, and I'm sorry Diane left us, I just wanted to clarify the difference between those programs. When you hear someone like Diane, what goes through your mind, Mark Winnie?
That's those are very important stories, and they need to be told as often as possible. And one thing that I'm sympathetic and want to see what can be done to make her life and the lives of others like her as easy as possible, I'm also wonder about the standards that we set in this country and the expectations that we have. You know, if we are, quote, poor, does that mean that we should be doing things that everybody else doesn't do in terms of food? Mm-hmm. Why should we be sort of going to extraordinary means in order to secure our basic sustenance? When everybody else has ample access to, you know, the best food available and doesn't have to even, you know, blink when they go through the checkout counter. That's the question I keep raising, is why do we have a standard or an expectation that low-income people should go to extraordinary means to secure their food, should have to kind of eat much lower on the food chain, and while everybody else can pretty much do what they want. We've never seen such abundance in this country. The fastest growing segment of our food industry is in the organic segment. More and more people are looking for food and realizing that food is going to make a difference in their health. It's an important aspect of their lifestyle. It sort of tells stories about who we are culturally and otherwise. I mean, she mentioned that Laotian people are using, use the coupons to buy food at farmers' markets.
It sounded like she was actually saying that they would accept them. They're the vendors, and they would accept them, and others would not.
Yeah, I don't know the details of that. Mm-hmm. But, if produce is something that's a big part of your culture and your diet, and always has been, then you're going to be flocking to those sources.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I'm talking about what expectations and standards are that we seem to have in this country. I don't want to go out there and say, because you are poor, you should be buying beans and only eating beans or eating really low on the food chain when everybody else around you is doing much better than that. Now, that's a good survival strategy, and we all need those survival strategies when times get tough. But I don't think we should view that as the norm.
Yeah. Eric in Madison is with us now. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I went to college in Michigan, and I just recently graduated. And I was working 20 hours a week and a full-time student, so things were kind of tight. And I did some research on some programs that were available to me as a student, and I found food assistance was one of those. So I told all my friends, and we signed up, and it really helped us out, making only $400 a month wages and then getting an extra $200 to $300 for the food assistance. It really helped out. So that was kind of an important factor when looking at grad schools, and I was looking at UW. And I realized that Wisconsin, it did not allow food assistance to college students. And I was just wondering if your guest could maybe comment on why some states do and some states do not and how that affects certain students.
I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. I do. I didn't know there would be that kind of variation from state to state. If you're getting food stamp eligibility is pretty much uniform across the country. The standards and regulations that govern that program are pretty uniformly applied from state to state. Mm-hmm. So it surprises me that you'd have one way of doing it in Michigan and a different way in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a different program than food stamps, though. Some sort of special, some sort of work-study type program, Eric, it sounded like?
Nope. It was the food stamps that you're thinking of.
Oh, all right. We had major welfare reform in this state, so I don't know if that had something to do with it. I wonder. And that concerns you, doesn't it, Mark Winnie?
Yeah, I don't think, again, I don't think that we should be having, different standards from state to state. I think, that a lot of the, the reason we have federal food assistance programs as opposed to, a Wisconsin food assistance program and a Michigan food assistance program is because we found in the past that, that there would be some states that would have very low standards and deny benefits to all kinds of needy people. So we needed to have that kind of uniform approach, which is why we often have federal programs. It's to provide some equality and some fairness across state lines. I would say, investigate that situation further, perhaps talk to some people, like talk to somebody at the Dane County Food Policy Council. They might have some ideas for you.
We only have a couple of minutes left. I'm trying to think how optimistic you are, Mark Winnie. I recall hearing a lot of people saying the war on poverty, led by Lyndon Johnson, just didn't work. Do you think that we can win a war on poverty?
Yeah, it's funny. I find myself defending Lyndon Johnson. That's not really my intention in life. But we have the Head Start program, which came out of the war on poverty. We have some great housing programs that came out of the war on poverty. There's been a number of very effective and important anti-poverty efforts that came out of that time. But, it's not the program. People always get a little too wrapped around the axle when it comes to the program and the politician and an era. Let's think about how engaged and concerned we might have been in the 1960s and the 1970s that we wanted to end poverty. That was important. It wasn't the program. I mean, we experimented a lot, and like any experiment, sometimes we just plain fail. But we learn from that mistake and we move on. We don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that's been, I think, our problem. We threw the baby out with the bathwater. We decided that we were going to use food banks as a way to feed the country. We that was more of a default position. We did that because we had no other choice. Let's take a look at that. Let's go back and look at what we used to do. Let's find out what worked and what didn't. Let's find out what we now know about nutrition and health and the connection to food that we didn't know 20 years ago. We've learned a lot. We've also seen enormous growth in the interest in local food, local agriculture. I mean, farmers markets, we had only a couple hundred in the 1970s. There's 4,500 farmers markets across the country. It's a great story.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Mark Winnie, the guest, the book, Closing the Food Gap. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.